Brian Message has been on the Banter Interview wishlist for ages, and it's fantastic to welcome him to our studio. He manages such acts as Radiohead, PJ Harvey and Nick Cave, and he's also the man behind ATC Management. In a wide-ranging interview, Brian spoke about his 20 years in the music business, how he got started in management in the first place, the growth of ATC, his views on the current label ecosystem, his thoughts on the live industry, the new PJ Harvey album, and the qualities it takes to be a good manager. We're joined here in the Banter at the Web Summit studio by Brian Message. Welcome to Banter, Brian.
Nice to be here to Banter.
Good, excellent to have you. Let's start with most people, the narrative about Brian Message is always Brian Message and Radiohead. I know there's more to Brian Message than Radiohead because you said on stage for a start that you've been in the business 20 years and there is always life before and after an Oxford five-piece band come into your life. Where did you start out? How did you start out?
Me? God, blimey, that's an interesting question. I'm an accountant by profession. But keep that to ourselves, can we? Yeah.
Yeah.
After graduating from college with a geography degree, I thought I'd better learn some numbers. So I went and did an accountancy qualification. I did all of that mostly because I wanted to find my own business. Took me up to the age of about 24. Mm-hmm. I then spent a few years scrabbling around trying to set up my own business, failing miserably in most things.
What kind of sectors were you looking at? Was it music or was it something
else? No, it was everything. So, in fact, I worked for a period of time with a Quasar. You remember indoor laser games? Did you ever come across that?
Yeah, I remember those, yeah.
So I did that. I think they were backed by an Irish leisure company, from memory. And did a whole bunch of things. Attempted startups, sort of was failing miserably. I then thought, you know what, I'm probably going to have to work for a bigger business because I was getting to my wit's end. And I was going to go and work for a company, or just had my third interview actually with a company called McKinsey's Management Consultancy. And as I'm literally walking down the steps in Pall Mall, in my last remaining suit, I got a phone call from a guy saying that EMI Records has got a strange job. Do you want to have a look at it? So I looked at music and thought, wow, music's really entrepreneurial. And I'm going to meet some people. I'm sure if I join EMI, I'm going to meet some people. So even though the salary was kind of like half, and in fact the salary was less than my mortgage from memory, that's right. I thought, you know what, I'm going to give it a shot. And fortunately, within 6 months, I met these two guys, Chris and Bryce, who were managing Radiohead and still do, and are, you know, epitomize the Radiohead thing. We hooked up and I managed to convince them it was a good idea that I became partners with them.
Okay, excellent. So, but like, I mean, what you've done since though, I mean, like that, they run Core Chart, am I right?
That's right. That's
so right. you've got ATO then. So I mean, ATO.
ATC.
ATC. Damn.
ATO is a record label. Bigger, better business.
Okay. ATO is a record label, isn't it?
Yes. ATO is, that's
okay,
right.
ATC, yeah. ATC. ATC is a very interesting model. I know a couple of people involved with ATC. I might as well name them here because he that's where he's getting his people from. Alex Bruford and Joe Taylor. Alex Bruford is very tall.
Yeah.
And Joe Taylor is very smart. And and you've also got Summit as well.
Summit is
a very, very nice guy. He gave me the best email put down ever around a PJ Harvey story. It was great. Really polite, but he did it right. But like, I look at what you've done with ATC, and it's really, really smart operation. So when did ATC establish? And maybe kind of like talk about like, I mean, that kind of, I suppose, that full stack approach to how you're doing music with it.
ATC started, I suppose, back in 2002. In fact, our first artist that we managed was Gemma Hayes.
Ah, okay, yeah.
A local lady.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, look, somewhat naively at the time, having worked through the 90s with Chris and Bryce and Radiohead and Supergrass, I thought, hey, you know what, this management game is all right, isn't it? It's quite easy. And then, of course, dive into managing probably the first four or five acts that we managed. Gemma did quite well on the first record, but unfortunately for a bunch of circumstances out of our control, it sort of spiraled. But we had a string of artists where we were just not getting any traction, getting off the ground. And that proved to be quite, I suppose, influential in terms of evolving our thinking. And so we started to think more about, you know what, let's have a scenario where we're not always just taking artists to record labels, etc., and let's try and keep evolving new ways of doing things. And obviously that sort of coincided with advancements in technology and all that kind of stuff. And then when the whole In Rainbows thing happened in 2007-ish, you know, that again was another sort of emboldenment really to go off and go and try and do some things differently and be And I suppose, you know, just keep being, trying to inspire, I suppose. Mm. Just trying to do things.
But in order to do that, you need two things. I mean, one, you need the actual acts who have traction. I mean, you have got, like, uh-huh. you've got like Nick Cave, Peter Harvey, you've got acts coming through like Catfish and the Bottled Men as well.
Yeah.
You, and, but you also need smart people around you. You know, you also need to kind of like me make sure you're well, you've good human resources as well. Yeah. Has that been difficult? The latter, the human resources, bringing in the right people? Or have there been times when you've hired people and it's just been, Jesus Christ, what were we thinking?
Yeah, look,
not like, naming like names, in any not business, naming names.
But for me, people like Sumit and Alex and are great guys, you know, and they are great partners to have and work. And at some level, when you come across those guys, it's reasonably easy to see at work. But you have, you know, we've got people in the office. We have a great guy called Matt Greer, actually, who does Frank Carter on the Rattlesnakes.
Oh, yeah.
Frank Carter, former Gallows guy.
Yeah.
When he first came in as an assistant, he was a shambles. And we sort of have to move him around, and actually eventually we found his footing, which was being a manager rather than a support staff or a central services person.
Mm.
So, you know, it's sometimes it's obvious and sometimes it's not so obvious.
Mm. How many acts does ADC look after at the moment from a management point of view?
On a management tip, I would say probably about 35. Okay. And that's out of London and Los Angeles.
Okay. So, and like me, how many managers then would you have? Like partners?
So we have frontline managers. I would say we now have about 12.
12, okay. 12, 25. That's a pretty good stable. Did Guy Osseri give you a call and say, come on, join the Maverick gang? Did Scott Rogers say, come on, join me in this great odyssey? Were you tapped for that?
Well, prior to all of that, there had been various conversations with guys from the Live Nation camp who wanted to look at that. But it wasn't really for us. I think what they do actually is really cool, but it just didn't feel like it was the right thing for us.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's a curious setup. I find this idea of all these kind of like really big managers coming together in a kind of a collaboration very unsettling in some ways and interesting in others. I mean, unsettling in that, like, I don't know, is this a kind of a play to be kind of like to outplay Irving in many ways and have another kind of front line, or is this some kind of new thing involving technology? What's your own views on generally?
Look, I see the logic behind it, and the pulling managers together, which obviously wasn't something that we do as well. The idea is to try and help build some level of critical mass to then have central services, whether that's tour marketing, digital marketing, royalty analysis, all of those things, because, you know, the bucks nowadays stops more with the manager than anybody else. And the manager's there trying to run a whole bunch of revenue streams, not just the record stream, which is obviously now relatively small as a record stream. It's really critical in terms of the art, but it's all the other revenue streams are really important. So if you wanna be in the business of making and developing artist businesses, you need to have the tools at your disposal. Now, for one manager with three acts, say, which is kind of what we try to work off, maybe three, four maximum, you can't have your own digital person, your own tour marketing person, your own royalty collection person. You know, it's difficult to do that. So by coming together, you get access to far greater opportunities, you know.
But like at the same time, I mean, those services can be provided by independent operators like Cobalt or BMG, both of whom you mentioned earlier on when you were speaking at the Web Summit here. You know, it's interesting because, like, I see an awful lot of kind of duplication in terms of what, like, I mean, Guy Osseri and Maverick are trying to do, you know. Is this in the best interest maybe of the act? Because sometimes people forget that it's the actual act who hires you as managers rather the other way around.
Yeah, you know, look, we get fired a lot, so we constantly get reminded that actually, you know, we are the ones that get hired and fired. You're right, there's a lot of... The great thing nowadays is there are a lot of good services. You know, I'm a big fan of Cobalt Label Services. They've been great partners with a number of acts, including, obviously, most notably, Nick Cave.
Yeah.
But the thing is, as well, where it works is if you're a manager, a day-to-day manager, you've got so many things to do. Whether that's touring, schedules, contracts, etc., etc., etc. Particularly when things you come onto things like digital marketing and tour marketing, if there's not somebody in your organisation that's pushing a digital agenda, so take Frank Carter as a case in point. We don't have much money to spend. The day-to-day manager is working hard to keep the whole thing rolling and on the line, and the band are a really savvy, they know what they're doing, smart guys. You've got to have someone in the organization going, hey guys, you know what, something is showing on the monitor screen that something's kicking off in Belgium. We need to go and have a look. We need to talk to some people. So that kind of intelligence at some level is really key. And you're not always going to get that from all your service providers, particularly because in a management business, you're looking at a whole range of things. Your promoter may not spot that, you know, is happening in Belgium. We've got an Kyla LaGrange, actually, where there's definitely something going on out there. So, you know, we had a meeting just on Monday about, all right, look, the data's showing us some stuff. We're not quite sure what it is, but it's enough for us to go to their management team and go, right, let's get focused on this, to go to the label services who are working with it and say, right, we need to get focused and we need to drill into this. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have those central services, then it would be tough, you know. Mm-hmm. Look, I think a lot of the big American management setups say they really hone in on the power element of it, power to attract, all that kind of stuff.
Mm. Because, I mean, what you just mentioned there in terms of, like, I mean, seeing with someone, you got the example of Kyle LaGrange, you know, that's where data comes in. And, like, I mean, it's knowing how to properly analyze that data, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a skill that, like, I mean, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it wasn't there, you know, because there was no need for it.
No, and I would still say we are probably 10% efficient at the moment. You know, we are seeing some stuff. We are starting to take some action on some stuff, but we're not really then utilizing it well.
Mm.
So I think there's a massively long way to go. And you're talking about trying to get people to change their way of doing things, which is never easy.
Well, that brings me neatly to the next question, which is the record label side of things. You mentioned the radio ones, a smaller piece of the pie currently, you know.
Yeah.
I've seen some interesting things. I'm curious to see how, does a manager kind of like agree with this? I've seen some interesting changes with record labels over the last 5 years. They seem to be back in the A&R game. They seem to become a lot more savvy and a lot more kind of like slimmed down. You know, they just seem to be reacting an awful lot better. Is that your experience? I mean, obviously there is the legacy factor. There's the legacy factor of like a lot of people who should have retired a long time ago. It's the legacy factor of people who haven't got over the fact that Steve Jobs did a job on them back in the day. So all these kind of legacy things. Have things changed?
When you say record labels like that, do you mean like the major record labels?
Yes, the majors.
Yeah, because look, one of the things I often say to anybody that wants to be in the management business or any artist that is looking to become successful, you need to find a small team of people who are going to stick with you and work with you and roll with you. The independent label sector is very good at that. And I get very encouraged by things when you see the stats, like, I think, well, in North America, the independent label sector is greater and bigger in size than Universal's market share, for example. So I think it's an important distinction to make. The major labels, yes, they've had to slim down. Obviously, their business model got a coach and horse ridden right through the middle of it. I think there is more A&R. There's more money available. There's only three of the majors now, rather than what 10 years ago. What, there were six? Were there? Was it six and then
six,
five?
Yeah, six, yeah.
Six,
six,
five, four, three. I don't think it's going to change from that.
Yeah.
I suppose Warner's is a major still. Yes, absolutely. So those, you know, their philosophies are very different now. You know, I look at Universal Music and I see them driving, and at some level, understandably, driving equity investments in tech. You know, if you can earn $500 million from a tech startup, you know, why necessarily would you want to be too heavily invested in the music game?
Yeah, and that, I mean, one of the major labels, biggest, I suppose, and most contentious tech players has been Spotify, you know. And like, I hate bringing up Spotify again, because I mean, they have become a bit of a whipping boy when it comes to streaming. I look at what's happened with Spotify, it's as a positive thing, you know.
Yeah, me too.
And I know you do from previous interviews, you've kind of talked about this. Do you think, you know, there is going to come a time in the next couple of years where the obsession with Spotify will stop, in terms of like, I mean, the scare stories around it, the royalty stories, that people will cop on and realize that, like, as I think it was like you or Steve, like I said earlier on, that the conversation really should be between an artist and their label, as opposed to an artist giving out about Spotify if they're playing about their royalty check.
I personally don't think we should overestimate all of that hyperbole about it, or hyperbole. Is that the right word?
Hype.
Which one? We'll go with hype. You know, it clearly it's newsworthy. You know, if Taylor Swift says something, it's newsworthy. You know, all those things are newsworthy. So, but they don't reflect the reality of what's going on out there. So I tend to take all of that stuff with a little bit of a pinch of salt. And I just go, does that service work for fans of music? And everywhere I go, people's fans are saying the same thing. Spotify, particularly young kids, I see kids now wanting to do premium if they can afford it, because the freemium's got all the ads. If they can't afford it, they're very happy with the freemium or ad revenue, whichever one we're going to call it. So if they're happy and that's working, then the big media news stuff, which obviously drives different
agendas.
It doesn't really mean a great deal to me, to be honest.
Have you seen examples from, like ATC's acts, of where a kind of it's called very loosely a partnership with Spotify has paid off? I'm thinking about, I've come across a number of stories in the last while of various acts who've done kind of very casual half an hour sessions with Spotify, be it in New York or London.
Yeah, yeah.
And next thing, you're looking at millions of plays. And in some cases, they're getting revenue back, which is equivalent to like selling 100 albums a day in the old days.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, Fink is a good case in point for us. Right. Fink has got something good going on Spotify that we're getting for want of using a better terminology, he's over-indexing on his streaming plays. Did I just say that?
You said that, but you're going to have to explain what that means, because this is one I haven't heard that term before.
Yeah, no, that's
a new buzzword, bingo.
I think it's an old buzzword from the 80s, I think, actually. Right. Now, look, he is punching above his weight. No doubt about it, his streaming plays are really interesting. I don't look at the numbers in terms of the revenue side of things. It's more interesting as what does that mean for his business? What does that mean in terms of what we can do as a strategy? And it's telling us a message that people are listening to his music. That's a shot in the arm always round. You know, Fink will probably, the band's sitting there going, hey, you know, we should keep going, we should keep driving, keep pushing. And the management team is the same. And, you know, it gives everybody a shot in the arm. Mm. Again, in terms of the revenue that's coming through, I think Spotify been pretty open in terms of what their numbers are. What then comes through depends a little bit as to who's in the middle. If you've got a label services deal, it's pretty transparent. You know what's going to happen. If you're signed to a traditional record deal, it's probably a little different.
Exactly. Let's leave the record side alone now for a moment and move on to another area that it strikes me it's rarely discussed. It's the live side. You know, the live side of the business is one. It's always struck me, if someone's been observing the industry a long time, that the live side remains very, very conservative. I'm curious from your point of view as a manager who's involved in a lot of different acts, a lot of different markets. Mm. How do you view, the increasing corporatization of the live sector with the growth of people like Live Nation, AG, and the way they have their tentacles into things with Festival Republic and things like that? Do you think it's a good or a bad thing, or is that just too much of a binary kind of like question to be asking?
It's definitely a thing, for sure. Our experience of it to date has been good, I have to say. No issues. Is the business on the whole conservative? Yes, it is. It's, for example, as I might have said earlier, the live sector likes to see an album coming so that they can plan what to do next. It's a tentpole moment for those guys. So, you know, hence why I suppose us as managers often keep pushing artists to do albums, because there's so much of the revenue comes through ticketing and touring profits. So that side of it's is obviously quite conservative. Mm. In terms of the big players, look, it's the way of the world, isn't it? Every industry has the same thing. No matter whether you're car manufacturers, record labels, live businesses, there's a massive consolidation.
Mm. Do you think, in terms of consolidation with Live Nation in particular, with, say, Ticketmaster, especially with the kind of like the secondary ticket agencies like GetMeIn and things like that, there's a squeeze on? You know, obviously you as an artist manager are saying to your agents, we want a proportion of the kind of like the rebates that are flying around the place. Do you think that's, in terms of transparency, is that ever going to change?
I personally never find it so much of an issue, and I think we have choices as to how we want to do some stuff. On Nick Cave's business, for example, his last North American touring, we didn't use an agent. We just did mostly direct deals with AEG. That was the right thing for us to do with him, and it was completely transparent across the board, sharing of data and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes with a different act, we might use an agent and not so much a promoter. Mm. So it depends. Some level depends on who the companies are. Live Nation and Ticketmaster are getting much better at sharing data than they used to be. That was an issue for a while, but we see that moving. They've got an artist services department which you need to go and talk to and get the data.
Yeah.
That's obviously then, you know. So I think that I see some progress in the right way. Certainly in respect of how we run our or our client businesses.
Yeah, I'm curious. There's an interview recently with Scott Roger, and he was talking about what managing Arcade Fire and Paul McCartney means for him, and he mentioned leverage once or twice. Like, how important is it for ATC as a whole, for your whole management business as a whole, the fact that you've got kind of like blue chip clients like PJ Harvey, Radiohead, and Nick Cave? Does it give you added muscle when you go to negotiate sometimes?
Yeah, for sure. No, it does, and of course, it's quite attractive for young talent as well. You know, when we are going in there, it's like a highly competitive market. It's a useful thing to have that history and to have those people with you, you know. Mm. And particularly those acts that you mentioned, because they're very well respected by, you know, huge chunks of the creative industries.
Mm. A music nerd question. You've obviously heard the new PJ and Harvey album, which is due out next year. Is it as good as we hope it'll be?
Outstanding. And what was outstanding about it as well, for me, was having done we actually recorded the record in Somerset House as an exhibition, and the translation of actually doing it in that sort of, I don't know if you heard about this.
Oh, I heard about it, yep. There's a friend of mine who's a PJ Harvey super fan, hello Caroline, and she told me all about that.
Okay, yeah, where fans could go and watch it through, you know, through the one-way glass. I think that has helped make this thing into sort of, you know, feel like a really big record. So
yeah, I mean, it must be interesting with artists like, say, Nick Cave and PJ Harvey, and that, like, it's not normal. It's not just about the kind of, like, I mean, tour album cycle. There's also kind of like, you know, there's a literary side and an artistic side running as well. Are those challenges that, like, are interesting to manage?
Yeah, very much so. From a personal perspective, I sort of get off on new things. You know, it's tough to go and do what we did with Polly in Somerset House. It's, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. You've never done it before. There's a lot of vulnerability putting oneself up on show like Polly did, etc. So, you know, there was a lot of vulnerability back in the Radiohead days in terms of In Rainbows, you know, not servicing the album to media first, and so that the media got on the same day. That was unheard of at the time, and we all sat there going, "Oh my god!"
That's become the norm now. I find that really weird. We as journalists kind of accept the fact that we'll get the album after it appears on Spotify. I mean, looking in the Dre album, you know, when the Dre album was released, obviously on Apple Music, you know, it wasn't service. Yeah. What Radiohead did back in 2007 with In Rainbows, that's now the norm.
Yeah, but I think for me, going back to your question, is it's all about the inspiration bit. So when Nick does his film 20,000 Days on Earth. The germination of that started from a whole bunch of decisions that we made where we were chucking the rule book out. So even just having cameras in his recording studio back on Push the Sky Away was something different. You know, and there was this air of doing things different. When he sort of goes and does his Sick Bag song, it's something different. It gives another counterpoint. So that then gives another texture to the... And doing all those things... whether they succeed commercially or don't succeed commercially, the point is actually it's all part of that texture of having something creative going on and inspiring a bunch of people. And so I personally really like it. I've just been working with Paul Thomas Anderson and Johnny Greenwood on this project called Yunnan, which again, it's just, you know, Johnny said, it's the summer of 2014, I think, goes, I know this guy... Shai Bensur in Israel, he's a really good musician. He works with his Indian musicians. I'd like to go and make a record in, which is going to probably be sung in Hindi, Urdu, and Hebrew. That sort of thing, for me, is a turn on. I'm like, yeah, come on, let's make it happen. And things spiral then. You know, Shai manages to convince the Maharaja in Jodhpur to give us his fort. Nigel Godrich says, right, let's go and erect a makeshift studio. Paul Thomas Anderson goes, hey, if you're going to India for 3 weeks to this fort, I'm coming too, and I'm going to bring my camera. You know, roll on another 9 months, and we have a film out, rolling out around the world, and a record coming out in 2 weeks' time. So that stuff is really interesting.
That's fascinating, because I mean, that's obviously better than dealing with some brand ringing up wanting to know can use 30 seconds of a song.
Yes, but there's often a bit of money in that one, isn't there?
Final question, Brian, and thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Like, I mean, you're one of the interviews I've been after for quite some time, so it's great to finally meet you and great to finally talk to you. Give some advice to maybe some young man just listening. You know, what kind of qualities should they have besides patience, persistence, and a good head for figures?
It's a good place to start. I like that. That was really cool. That's very good. You know, look, I think you've got to try and keep pulling together people that are good that work that you can work with. The team thing for me is a big one. Always, I don't want to use that word, pushing the envelope, but always trying to keep driving creativity, keep inspiring, keep being inspired. Those things are really key to me. And I think if you can do that, plus add those bits in that you talked about, no business, whether you're a manager or an artist nowadays, and you're trying to set yourself up, is easy. You're in competition with lots of people all around the world who are all trying to do the business. You know, the fact that you can reach everybody's mobile phones, theoretically, the fact that you can make music for next to no money, you can make videos for next to no money, you have an opportunity. All the tools are there for you to have a business, but that doesn't guarantee you that you're going to be successful. Mm. Just like in any other industry or any other business sector, you've got to be good at what you're doing if you're going to be a startup. And you know, you've got to focus in on that. There's no divine right to be successful. The tools are there. Use them, but you've got to be good and you've got to be creative.
Cool. Brian Message, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thanks a million to Brian for joining us at Banter, and to Mary, Elner, Mike, and all of the Web Summit media team for their help with this series of interviews. This podcast was recorded and produced by Garrett Hines, and thanks to Erica from Bodytonic for her assistance. We hope you've enjoyed this interview. Please remember to check out our other podcasts from Web Summit 2015, and of course, the regular series of Banter podcasts. You can find these and details of all upcoming Banter events at thisisbanter.com. We'll talk to you soon. Cool.